Well, one thing we've learned, the heater works. As Jesus was traveling from Judea to Galilee, John's gospel account records a familiar incident with a Samaritan woman at Jacob's well in John chapter 4. It took place near Mount Gerizim, where the Samaritan temple had been built. And he engaged the Samaritan woman in a conversation about water. And then abruptly, he changed the subject as he asked her to go get her husband. She answered that she didn't have a husband. And he said, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is that you've had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband." John 4, 16 through 18. Have you ever wondered if this woman's lifestyle was typical of the lifestyle of the people of Sychar, the city from which she came? Or maybe if her situation raised the eyebrows of the townspeople? Or did she fit into the lifestyle of the average citizen there at Sychar in Samaria? Well, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I'd like to consider some of the things that it takes to live in a society where her situation is commonplace. And young people, I forgot that most of you weren't going to be here last Sunday night, and I preached you a lesson, so beg your parents to get the tape and let you listen to it, or you sign up for it, because I think there might have been some things that might help you in your life. And to be real honest with you, I think there might be some things in this lesson that might help you in your life also. Present trends indicate that somewhere around 50% of all the new marriages that this year will end in divorce. And interestingly, the more educated you are, the more likely you are to get a divorce. And although polygamy is illegal in America, we're surrounded by lots and lots of folks who have many mates at one time. And it seems like that it's become the common way for things to be done, that you live with each other for a while and then you decide if you want to get married. Most distressing of all is the fact that that trend is not exclusive to the world. That in becoming, we as the church are becoming more like the world, and the culture in which we live. And I'd like to just briefly this evening consider some principles to ensure that we live as God's chosen people while we're living among the Samaritans, as it were. And the first thing is that we do, in fact, live by a double standard in this world as Christians. I've had the opportunity to talk to a number of people who are considering breaking up their marriage. And quite often, I hear things like, "We're miserable in this relationship and we'd both be a lot happier out of it. Why should we stay together? After all, who stays together these days anyway?" And implied in these words is a belief that we should not expect any more of Christians than we expect from the rest of the world. And to many, it may come as a shock that God has a higher standard of conduct for His children. People of the world certainly don't understand that, and you can't expect them to. But we, as God's children, need to make it really clear in our life as early as possible that we do live by a different standard of the world. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9, beginning, "I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with immoral people." And then he said, "I wrote to you this earlier, and I need to clarify something. I did not at all mean with the immoral people of this world, or the covetous, swindlers, or idolaters, for then you'd have to go out of the world. But actually, I wrote to you not to associate with any so-called brother if he should be an immoral person, or covetous, or idolater, a reviler, a drunkard, or a swindler, not to even eat with such a one. For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Do you not judge those that are within the church? But those that are outside, God judges. Remove from among yourselves such a wicked person. There is obviously a double standard. And whenever we really get to feeling alone, particularly I'm thinking of young people, when we really get to feeling alone and feeling like we don't fit, then it may be hard for us to tell our children, but that's the way it is. That's the way you're supposed to feel. You don't fit in the world. You don't live by the same standards that they do. Neither do your parents, neither do any of us as God's people. Is it a shock to discover that God expects more from us than he does from people who are not Christians? We do live by a double standard. Paul writes in Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2, I urge you, therefore, brothers, by God's mercy, to present your bodies a living, holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world. And the literal translation here would be, do not be fashioned according to this age. And if you stop and think about what he said, do not be fashioned according to this age. Do not be configured to this age. It means that the way that the people of our society think, we are not to think that way. And we don't fit in with that. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds that you may prove what the will of God is, which is good and acceptable and perfect. J.B. Phillips' translation says, do not let the world press you into its mold. I'm not so old that I don't remember some of the pressures of being young and how much I wanted to fit in. And how I protested to my parents whenever I was not allowed to do some things that my friends were all allowed to do, and saying to them, well, everybody's doing it. And pretty much everybody was doing it. Because as a matter of fact, I grew up in an extremely small church, and if there was one young person my age, I was extremely fortunate. We have a large contingency of young people here. That's one of the beauties of Woodland Oaks, that we do have such a large number of fine young people. And you have young people, you have friends who will encourage you along those lines. I know that you also have some friends that call themselves Christians that are not living like Christians. That happens wherever you are, and that hurts. That makes it even more difficult whenever your friends that are Christians are also doing the same thing that people in the world are doing, then that makes it doubly difficult. But if you truly want to please God, you need to know at the very outset that we do live by a double standard in this world. It shouldn't come as any surprise that we're out of step with our culture. And therefore, we should expect that the Christian's approach to things such as marriage and the non-Christian approach has very little in common. We walk to the beat of a different drum. And regarding marriage is a human illustration of the relationship between God and his people. And if we would keep it on that plane and understand that that's how God designed marriage to be, and what God designed marriage to illustrate is the relationship that he wants to his people, then it will put a different set of standards on us that we will accept. We will have a different level of expectations in our marriage. Believe me, I know, as a parent of four daughters, I know the pressures that young people feel in this society. And the pressures that come with not having and getting to an age where you're dating age, and you look around you and you don't see anybody that looks very Christian. You don't see anybody like your mom and dad have been telling you that there's going to be this guy, there's going to be this girl that God has planned for you that comes along somewhere. And you start looking for them and you don't see them anywhere. I went to the rodeo yesterday. And one of the things that, I'm sorry, but one of the things that I notice is how the young ladies dress when they go to the rodeo. And it seems like, I don't know how they dress normally, but I don't think they dress that way at school. But it's really amazing to me how much yesterday cold young ladies were willing to put up with in order to show a great deal of their bodies. And it was pretty cold yesterday. And Janice and I talked about this a little bit and made the observation that if somebody was willing to go to that kind of misery to gain the looks of others, there's probably no telling what else they might be willing to do to gain the looks and the attention of others either. We live by a different standard. God's plan for people since the beginning of time has been one man, one woman, for a lifetime. That's the standard. That's what God wants from us. And I know that every time that I preach a lesson like this or bring this kind of thing up in a lesson, in a sermon, that there is a risk that there will be some people who will be hurt, who will feel hurt by the teaching. And I'm really sorry about that. It's never, ever my intention to hurt anybody. But it is my intention, regardless of how much pain it inflicts on others, to teach to our young people the standard that God wants us to have as Christians. And if there have been those, maybe even in our own families, who have made poor decisions and bad decisions and have ended up wrecking marriages, then they don't want you to do that. Christ certainly doesn't want you to do that. And so we need to lift our standards up and keep those standards up. It does not matter that the world has abandoned God's plan. God still calls for His people to live by this standard. It's a lifetime covenant. When Paul dealt with the problem of mixed marriages, and by mixed marriages I mean Christians and non-Christians in the first century, His instruction was for the believer to stay in that marriage. God expects us to honor our commitments regardless of what others may or may not do, even if that's our spouses. And that certainly does put a great deal of emphasis on you making a wise decision in the person that you choose to date and ultimately choose to marry. And it's quite often true that young people who want to date will date someone that you don't really want to marry. That's a really dangerous thing. It's a really dangerous thing. If you know that this person is someone that you don't want to marry, you probably shouldn't date them. Because you will very likely, most likely, end up marrying someone that you've dated. And if you started out realizing this is probably not a person that I would want to marry, then you would really be wise to decide, I don't need to date that person. Even if it means a Friday night and a Saturday night without a date. Even if it means a long time without a date. Then you keep yourself, one of the things that I hear so often young people say is, well, I just don't see anybody out there that I can marry. Well, you have to be the kind of person that if you ever do meet that person that you want to marry, you have to be the kind of person that they would want to marry also. And that's going to mean that between now and then, you're going to have to make some sacrifices. You're going to have to make some decisions. Because one day you may meet that guy or that girl that you'd like to marry, and they look you over and they don't see the kind of person that they'd like to marry. And so you need to keep yourself pure for that time when you do meet that person, so that they will be attracted to you just as you're attracted to them. God expects us to honor our commitments. The problem is not a lack of knowledge. It's not saying more about it. I don't know of anybody who enters a marriage expecting to get divorced. Even secular songs speak of love being forever and always. But there's something more than information that's missing. And one of the things, and that could launch into this whole thing having been the introduction, but don't get scared, it's not. But that could launch into a whole series of things that are missing in our lives if we get to that point. But I'd like to mention one thing, and that is, I believe that a primary missing ingredient is the church. And by that, I don't mean just coming sometimes. I mean being committed to the church, to God's family. Let me share with you some things that the church provides for marriage. The church provides a role model, or if you will, a kind of positive peer pressure. Every time we come together, you can look around and you see couples who've been together for 30, 40, 50, maybe even 60 years. And that provides encouragement. How many people, for those of you who were in the workforce, how many people are like that where you work? I don't say there's none, but there's not many, is it? You don't have that kind of example out there. And seeing such people gives us the courage to realize they didn't stay married for 40 or 50 or 60 years because they were both perfect people. They did because they loved the Lord, and they learned how to love one another, and they learned how to work through difficulties in their lives. And they had difficulties. Even struggling marriages encourage us, because we see people that are willing to stick it out and work hard to strengthen those marriages, and they don't just give up whenever difficulties come into their lives. The church provides a larger families within which our families can live, and we can struggle together, and we can be nurtured together, and we can survive together. The church is more than an information center. Paul reminds the Corinthian Christians in 1 Corinthians 12, the body is a unit, though it's made up of many parts. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. And so it is. And you may not realize that when you live within the church, but it is true. You realize it when you're out there. But to have a group of people, a family, who truly do care about your welfare and your family and your relationships, the church is a center for training the family. In Titus chapter 2, verse 1 through 5, Paul instructs the older women to be active in instructing the younger women how to be Christian wives and how to be Christian mothers. The church provides resources of age and experience, instruction, support. And when neglect or abuse occurs within a family, within our spiritual family, then family members step up and step in and hold individuals accountable for their behavior. And take up the slack, at least some of the slack, that happens within families sometimes. It's always encouraging to hear someone say of the church, they stood by us in our darkest hour. And they didn't leave. They walked with us through the struggle. And they were a family to us. And one of the most attractive things that we have here at this congregation is a large number of young families, particularly. And I'm thinking tonight of a young family that recently moved to this area. And when I knew they were moving, I talked to them and encouraged them to come and be a part of the Bible classes, because we had lots of young families their age. They've chosen not to do that. They visited a time or two, quick in, quick out. Don't talk to anybody. Haven't made any friends. Had the same difficulty where they came from. They had a new opportunity for a new start. But at least on the surface, it appears like they're not going to be a part of this family either. It's hard for me to understand why. Because there are struggles. They have struggles. They have an opportunity to find some help, to find some good Christian friends that can become a part of their life. Couples should work to build a strong network of Christian friends before trouble ever starts. Because the truth is, it's virtually impossible to develop the kind of mutual friendship that every marriage needs once a marriage is in crisis. You need to be developing those relationships now. I know that Valentine's Day is over, But I have a special story that I'd like to end this lesson with. In fact, it's called A Special Valentine's Love Story, and it was written by a preacher in Tupelo, Mississippi, recently. Her family had come to America from Sweden. She had typical Scandinavian look, long blonde hair, blue eyes, long slender legs, soft blemish-free skin, high cheekbones. She was gorgeous. She was beautiful. In fact, a professional international photographer in her hometown thought she was so pretty that he used to photograph her to advertise his business. But that was not her real beauty. She was raised by some wonderful Christian parents and became a Christian at an early age. Integrity, honesty, and sweetness were just a few of her characteristics. In fact, at her engagement party, her sister, who knew her better than anyone, said she had never heard her tell a lie. And all of her friends said the same thing about her. She was the sweetest girl they knew. She would never speak a harsh word about anyone. Everyone loved to be around her. A young man she met in her freshman year started dating her and fell in love with her. Both her exterior, photographic beauty, and the wonderful godly character of her inward beauty. She fell in love with him, and they spent every free moment they could with each other over the next 4 years. They were committed to each other, and they believed in waiting long before True Love Waits campaign ever existed. 1 week after they graduated from college, they were married. They loved each other's company. They would walk together, exercise together, go on bike rides together, chaperone youth trips together, go to movies, watch TV, eat pizza, travel, all the things that any normal couple would love to do together. They were so much in love. She taught school for a year, then became a bookkeeper for a surgical supply company. One day, while she was working, for no apparent reason, she lost her balance and fell on the floor. She was later able to get up and went to see a doctor that night. He sent her to see a neurologist. The following day, it happened again. For no apparent reason, she lost her balance and fell. This time, though, she couldn't get up. She had lost all feeling in her legs. They wouldn't move. Her husband had to come to the office and pick her up in his arms and carry her to the hospital. After 6 days in the hospital, the doctor gave this beautiful, active young lady the dreadful news. She had multiple sclerosis and she would continue to deteriorate. This young couple, who had now been married only 18 months, who loved to go everywhere together and do everything together, would now face some new challenges. All their future plans would change. Everyday life would change. They would change. For the next 20 years, this young lady did deteriorate. She had to take steroids, not the kind athletes use, but anti-inflammatory steroids. Her bones became brittle and broke easily. Her face became puffy and bloated. She could not even put on her makeup. Her body was a mess. She went from a walker to an exercise scooter to a wheelchair. She could no longer feed herself. She could no longer write her name or control her bodily functions. She now had to have someone stay with her 24 hours a day. If that couple had not had the kind of committed love that's based first on a personal relationship and a committed commitment to Jesus, and second, on a love that's based on a commitment to each other, the marriage would never have lasted. In fact, a large percentage of the marriages where a spouse has MS, the other spouse leaves. The other spouse won't stay committed to the constant care and continual physical, psychological, and mental changes that continue to occur. Please hear me carefully. Those two young people are not heroes. They're not super saints or super Christians. They'll be the first to tell you that they're not super Christians. Those two people are normal, ordinary people, empowered by the love of God and love for each other, to do what the world considers beyond normal and extraordinary. I know this for a fact because that woman, that beautiful young lady who will never walk again, who can't feed herself, is Linda Langerfeld, my wife. She's not a hero. I'm not a hero. We're children of God, doing what children of God are supposed to do. doing what his children are called to do, doing what God expects of every man and every woman who makes a vow before God on their wedding day. Often Hollywood will portray a hero sacrificing his life for his heroine in a film. In the world's eyes, he's a hero. In God's eyes, he's an ordinary man making an extraordinary sacrifice that every Christian who's committed to his spouse ought to make. Sacrificial, committed love is the rule, not the exception. We're not super saints. We're not heroes when we're being faithful and committed to our spouses. We're doing what God has called every husband and every wife to do since the beginning of time. Today is a day to work on your future. Living among the Samaritans, it requires an uncommon commitment. It requires an early commitment in life. If you really, truly want to be successful, it requires the acceptance of a double standard in this world. You can't live like your friends and please God. For marriage, it requires a commitment, the acceptance of a commitment for a lifetime. And it requires being committed to the church family. Today is the day to work on your future while we stand and sing.
Come to Jesus, He will save you, though your sin has crimson glow. If you give your heart to Jesus, He will make it white as snow. Come to Jesus, come to Jesus, come to Jesus, come today. Come to Jesus, come to Jesus, come to Jesus, come today. Come to Jesus, dying sinner, other Savior there is none. He will share with you.